From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. In the latest round of collective bargaining last night, no agreement between Johns Hopkins Hospital Management and the hospital's service and maintenance workers. 2,000 workers have threatened to strike if a new contract is not reached by Wednesday. This morning, we speak with two workers, their union, and a labor law attorney. Then 2,000 university students, Amina Ruffin and Corey Johnson, won a national debate tournament in Indiana last week, the first African-American women's team to win a national debate title. They talk with Tom Hall about the art of argument. Plus, Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post join us to talk movies and a Baltimore story from Gil Sandler. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy, and you've tuned in to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org. Click on the Maryland Morning link. Now, on with the podcast.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Last night's contract talks between Johns Hopkins Hospital Management and hospital service and maintenance workers ended about 8 p.m. with no agreement. The collective bargaining process between management and 2,000 hospital maintenance technical and service workers started March 4th, and the workers' contract expired this past Monday, March 31st. In recent bargaining, Hopkins has moved closer to the $15 an hour that the workers called for. But the back and forth continues. If an agreement is not reached by Wednesday, the employees have threatened to strike. In a moment, we'll be joined by the vice president of the local chapter of 1199 SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which represents the workers, and by a labor lawyer who represents employers, not Johns Hopkins. We reached out to Johns Hopkins Hospital for an interview, and they said no and gave us this written statement. Quote, "We are negotiating with union representatives in good faith and are working to reach a settlement that's fair to everyone and reflects financial responsibility on the part of the hospital. Out of respect for our employees and their labor union, we are negotiating directly with them and not through the media," close quote. But first, we want to hear from one of the employees in the center of negotiations. Yesterday, we spoke with Kiva, who asked us to use only her first name, even though she's on 1199 SEIU's Collective Bargaining Committee. She's worked for Johns Hopkins Hospital for 12 years and makes $12.20 an hour as a floor tech in the Environmental Services Department.
I'm responsible for maintaining the upkeeping of the floors, stripping, waxing, buffing, all that. Right now, I'm staying with family. I'm a single parent. I have two boys. 1220 after 12 years is not acceptable. I think that it's important that people understand that we work in a number one facility and we get paid as if it's last on the list. We work there. We take pride in our work. We've been doing it for years. We don't want to leave. We just want to be okay when it comes down to being able to raise our families.
That's Kiva, one of the 2,000 Johns Hopkins Hospital maintenance and service workers who are in the midst of collective bargaining with the hospital. And now to talk about the process, I'm joined by Armita Dixon, vice president of 1199 SEIU for Baltimore Hospitals and Health Systems. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
And also joining me is Brian O'Keefe, labor law attorney for the firm Shaw and Rosenthal. O'Keefe is not affiliated with Hopkins. Brian, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Armita, the latest bargaining session started about noon yesterday, went into the evening. What happened?
We bargained. And a large part of bargaining is caucusing and discussing and trying to reach agreement or consensus with your side about what the next moves will be. But we're still bargaining.
Has Hopkins come closer to the union's position? In what way and in what way not?
Well, as you just noted, that they have moved closer to where we need them to be, but it's just not close enough.
And what compromises has the union made?
We made the compromises that we thought were necessary to make under the circumstances. We, and I won't get specific, but we have moved. We've made significant moves in our position.
And in all this, we're talking primarily about wages, about money, or are there other factors that...
If I can sort of frame this just a little for
please.
You. We bargained last year. We took a one-year contract with the understanding, and the understanding I'm talking about from the union's perspective, that our primary purpose in this bargaining would be finances, would be economics. Hopkins is an old contract. We've had it for a very long time.
Like so 40-some years?
That's your quote.
Okay.
It's probably right. But we didn't see a lot of language. There's not a lot of language problems in the Hopkins contract. And in that bargaining last year, we agreed to a labor management partnership to help resolve some other issues. So this was an economic bargaining.
That's what you
said. We were clear about that going in. So there's very little non-economics involved in this.
Brian O'Keefe, you represent management in contract negotiations like these. And as I said, you don't represent Hopkins. But can you give us briefly a kind of a context for who and what is involved in this process?
Well, you know, it's a very involved process when you're going to be into collective bargaining. It's not something where you just show up one day and sit at a table and just start from scratch. As my colleague here said, you know, Hopkins has a very old contract, so they're starting from a document that's been around for a very long time. And when you're going into bargaining like this, and again, I'm not directly involved with the Hopkins negotiations, but you've often done a lot of wage surveys. You've talked to benefits consultants. Senior management's been very involved in formulating what the company's proposals would be. And it's a very serious process for a company because you are locking yourself into a certain time period. You're not going to be able to make any changes for a certain time period. So it's a very serious process that management goes through and coming up with their own proposals and figuring out where they can go to try to meet the union in a way that everyone can win in the end. So it's a very involved process and a very serious process.
Talk to me specifically about the health sector, about how that unfolds for a hospital like Johns Hopkins.
Right. Well, I think there's, Maryland is unique in that we have this, the hospital rate setting it's done by the state, the commission that helps sets the rates for the hospital. Without passing judgment on that one way or the other, I think it just adds another unique angle that hospitals have to consider whenever they're negotiating in Maryland that you don't necessarily have in other states. But I also think just like a lot of other industries, hospitals are concerned about wages. They're concerned about healthcare. There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty right now out there with the Affordable Care Act and what type of impact that's going to have on premiums. So I think those are really two major issues that hospitals are facing as well as all employers are facing right now whenever they're coming up with bargaining proposals and trying to project, because again, you're locked into the contract for the time period that you agree to with the union. So I think it's a very thoughtful process that goes on from management side.
This is Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Brian O'Keefe, a labor law attorney for the firm Shaw and Rosenthal, and with Armita Dixon, vice president of 1199 SEIU for Baltimore Hospitals and Health Systems. We're talking about contract negotiations between Johns Hopkins Hospital Management and service and maintenance employees. I want to play a clip from a member of 1199 SEIU's bargaining committee who has worked for Hopkins for 19 years. He wants to be identified by his first name only, Bob. He works in the clinical engineering bed shop, repairing and maintaining hospital beds, stretchers, exam tables, and he makes $24 an hour, so he makes more than Kiva, whom we heard from earlier. But he says workers overall are not compensated fairly.
I'm a staunch conservative, okay? I believe in conservative values, but I also believe in livable wages to people. And the reason I'm here is not as much for me. I mean, I want a fair wage, too. I mean, they really underpay us for what we do. The phrase that's used there all the time is Hopkins is a great place to be from. People just come there, they know they're going to get low wages, and then they move on because they got the Hopkins name to their resume. But people like myself, we can't move on. I'm 63 years old. I can't move on anywhere.
Armita Dixon, Bob makes what some would think is a good wage.
Mm-hmm.
What is the current range of wages for the employees? And do senior employees like Bob, who've been there a long time, have incentives?
It
in
depends
place?
On what job title you're in. Bob happens to be in one of the higher paid job titles. But the salaries range currently from like $10.71, I think, for somebody walking in the door to up and including where Bob is, $24, $25 an hour, depending on what job you're in. Bob is a unique guy in a whole lot of ways, and his desire to participate in this struggle on a high level, because he's on the bargaining committee, is commendable. But I think what he says about people and their needing to have a living wage is critical to this discussion. I think what gets lost sometimes in the facts and figures is what is happening to people on a everyday sort of level. I lived in Baltimore my whole life. This is my home. And I have watched Johns Hopkins move almost into West Baltimore from East Baltimore with buildings and all the other things, which are truly wonderful, in which the workers in the union are really excited and supportive of Hopkins' growth and development. The problem is what they have not done is, in keeping with those moves, is given back to Baltimore what Baltimore has given to them. Because of some of the breaks Hopkins has gotten, they're allowed to do these wonderful things. But they have not reached back and done economically what they need to do for these workers. And that's the crux of our disagreement.
As I mentioned, 1199 SEIU has given Johns Hopkins Hospital Management till Wednesday morning, a deadline for a strike. Hopkins said in an emailed statement to the Baltimore Brew that if employees do strike, Hopkins has, quote, contingency staffing plans in place to assure no disruptions to patient care, close quote. If a strike does begin, are workers' pay and benefits frozen? Brian, what is the usual?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, at the outset, I think nobody, and I think Ms. Dixon would agree with this, nobody really wants a strike. I mean, nobody on management side truly wants a strike. I don't think anyone on the union side truly wants a strike. So I think you're always trying to continue to bargain and work together to get to a point where you're not having a strike. There can be a couple different types of strikes. Oftentimes in the healthcare industry, you might have a one-day strike or a two-day strike. The hospital will bring in sort of temporary replacements or extra staffing through their supervisors to kind of cover things. And in that circumstance, there's a minimal impact to employees. If there was a full-fledged strike, which would be very rare and very uncommon, I don't really think that Johns Hopkins is headed down that road yet. But if there would be a full-fledged strike, the employees would be, out on the picket lines, and they would not be receiving their regular wages, and they'd have to depend upon a union. Unions have strike funds usually to help kind of make up the difference for the employees, but the employees would definitely be in an unvulnerable position in that spot.
I'm Maria Dixon. We're almost out of time. Give me your final thought.
My final thought is we have been bargaining with Hopkins since the early part of March. We believe that if we keep working hard, we can reach an agreement. But Hopkins has to move off of their position on economics for these workers. There has to be a change.
And the next bargaining session is, as
Monday.
I understand, on Monday. Mm-hmm. I thank you both. Armida Dixon, Vice President of 1199 SEIU for Baltimore Hospitals and Health Systems. Brian O'Keefe, a labor law attorney with the firm Shaw and Rosenthal. More information on our website. Just ahead, great debaters at Towson. Stay with us on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast.
Assistant producer Jamila Kay. You've tuned in to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org. Click on the Maryland Morning link.
on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's been a huge few weeks for gifted women college students in Maryland. The University of Maryland women's basketball team is on the way to the Final Four. On Tuesday night, they upset the Louisville Cardinals on Louisville's home court to get within one game of the finals for the first time since 2006. They'll face undefeated Notre Dame on Sunday. And last month, Amina Ruffin and Corey Johnson, members of the Towson University debate team, won the Cross-Examination Debate Association National Championship. They are the first African-American women's team to win a national title. On their way to victory, they bested teams from Harvard, Michigan, NYU, and many other prestigious schools. Amina Ruffin and Corey Johnson join me in the studio. How are you doing?
Good.
This is so cool.
Thank you.
Totally cool.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you so
much.
That's
really great. So, Amina, tell us how this works. You're given a proposition, and you've got to argue one way or the other.
Yeah. So, at the beginning of the season starts in September, we start debating a resolution. This year's resolution was about restricting presidential war powers authority. And so in each debate, there will be an affirmative side and a negative side. The affirmative side will make an argument that's in relation to that resolution, and the negative side will refute that argument.
Mm-hmm. And Corey, you have argued through the course of the season for both positions, right?
Yeah, it's mandatory that you debate both sides of the resolution all year. So, you know, during the preliminary debates of each tournament, you have four affirmative rounds and four negative rounds.
And it's the same topic for each round?
Well, yes, it's the same resolution, but you can affirm that resolution in different ways, right? So there are many different presidential war powers. There are many ways that you can restrict presidential war powers. There are many methods by which we could restrict presidential war powers. And so there are different many topics inside of the resolution.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, so this resolution actually was in play for the whole season, not just this championship.
Yes.
So you really dug deep into this.
Yes, we started our research during the summer, and then throughout the year we kind of supplemented with more research. But yeah.
And as you go along, I mean, when you finish one competition, you come up with some more ideas. And stuff.
Yes.
So how do you do this? How do you prep for something like this?
Oh, Lord.
Sounds like a lot of work.
Yes.
You're both shaking your head. Going, oh, yes.
A lot of work.
Maybe I believe about 60 hours of work per week. We do a lot of research. We like to talk specifically about kind of bringing in lived experiences into discussing politics, discussing policies. And so in this year's discussion of Presidential War Powers Authority, a lot of our research discussed the way that people of color related to Presidential War Powers Authority, and also looking at some more critical ways, using some critical literature to approach the topic of Presidential War Powers Authority. And so we just all through the season did that research. So much research.
Yeah.
So much time
spent. Yeah. So, Corey, it's called the Cross-Examination Debate Championship. Do you get to literally cross-examine the other team?
Do you
talk to each other?
Yeah. So a huge part of debate is, well, cross-ex. But so we have the way the debate is set up, everyone has constructive speeches and rebuttal. So per each debater in the round, which is four debaters, two from the affirmative, two from the negative, everyone has one constructive and one rebuttal. And then in between those cross-exes, in between those speeches, there's a cross-ex. So everyone also has to answer questions. And so that's kind of where the most refutation happens, because both sides are speaking and trying to get their point across to the judge.
Mm-hmm. So this is a judged decision. So you win because the judges declare one team the winner or not.
Yes.
But when you're talking to the other team, are you trying to trip them up?
I mean, definitely.
There's a strategic advantage to asking. You want to punch holes in their argument.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. And so in cross-examination, you may want to try to get them to agree with your side. Ask them a series of questions so they kind of, their conclusion is what you want their conclusion to be, which is ultimately what your argument is. And so the judge is able to sit back and watch this, but at the same time, you're convincing the judge, because the judge is like, hey, well, they're agreeing with you. It seems like you must be right. So that's the fun part about
it. Oh, it does sound like fun. Yeah. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Amina Ruffin and Corey Johnson are with me here in the studio. They are from Towson University. They have just won the national debate tournament. It was in Indiana. They are the first African-American women to do this. So, Corey, do you have like a debate hero? I mean, are there rock star debaters that you whose style you like to emulate and like to be inspired by?
I have a few. I would like to think that Shannara Reed Brinkley and Liz and Tanya from Louisville and Shannon and Regina from Georgia State University are just a few of the black women that I've looked up to, because there haven't been a lot of black women in the activity of debate. And so them just being there has inspired me to do well in debate.
Now, are they your contemporaries? Are they people who've now graduated?
They are people that have long graduated, you know, with, I would say, 10 to 12 years. And so, you know, looking back at their success and looking back at all the roads that they paved, I would like to think for Amina and I to be here is, you know, just extraordinary to me. And that I think that pushes Amina and I to kind of like keep paving that way for, you know, little black girls that were in the same position that we were in when we were in school. Mm-hmm. So seeing them pave those ways make us, I think, want to pave that way.
When you all are preparing, do you ever disagree with each other? Do you debate each other about your strategy going into the debate?
Yes, very much so.
Is that a way of keeping yourself sharp?
We had a small little debate before the final round.
Yeah.
Because Corey did a lot to prepare the argument that we ran going into the final round. And I looked at the argument. I was like, yeah, okay, I really like this. And I was like, well, what if we change this one small part of the argument? And so we were kind of going back and forth for a little while during our preparation time, trying to figure out whether or not we would change that part of the argument, how we would change it. And we ended up changing that small part, but also being able to work together to figure out the best way to go.
And I think that works out. I think that works out best for us, because if you have two people that think exactly alike in debate, then you'll never be able to see the small things that need to change in order to, you know, be successful. And so I think that me and her sometimes disagreeing with certain positions of our arguments or kind
that'll
of seeing
help illuminate
past,
it. Yeah.
It'll help illuminate some of the fallacies within the argument.
Yeah. So last presidential election, did you watch President Obama and Governor Romney debate?
I did.
And were you sitting there like with an expert eye, said,
like,
oh, Obama should have said this?
Yeah.
That first one especially, were you just like going crazy?
Well, okay, so I turned 18 last year in July, so I'm still 18. And, you know, I see all of my peers, because I'm a sophomore in college, and so watching my peers, you know, oh, well, you know, I think this was great about, you know, Romney's debate, or this was great about Obama's, and I'm like, they're both pretty terrible at debate, actually. They're both pretty terrible. That's what I'm thinking in my mind, so.
All right, well, we'll leave it at that, because I'm not about to debate that or any other point of YouTube. I'm in way over my head here. All right. Well, thank you both. I really appreciate it. And congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
Amina Ruffin and Corey Johnson, they're students at Towson University. They won the Cross Examination Debate Association National Championship in Indiana last month. They're the first African American women to win a national debate tournament. We've got more information on our website. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after the break, what to see on the silver screen. Movie Mayhem with Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday after the news. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. I'm producer Stephanie Hughes. Go to our website for more podcasts, audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's WIPR.org. Click the Maryland Morning link.
And good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. And joining me in the studio, as they do on the first Friday of every month, Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
And Ann Hornaday, the esteemed film critic for the Washington Post. Perhaps you've heard of it. Nice to see you, Ann.
Thank you. Good to see you.
So, Jed, last night, a joint conference committee on the budget in the Maryland legislature agreed to provide up to $18.5 million in tax credits for filmmakers. People think about this in relation particularly to House of Cards and Veep, the two things that are shooting currently. But, of course, it's available to any and all comers. The governor had originally proposed $7.5 million, so the legislative body in their wisdom
up that figure considerably. Tim Wheeler reporting in The Sun this morning that the House Ways and Means Committee has yet to approve the credit increase, you know, and do their thing. But it looks like it's on its way to happening. You obviously think this is a good deal. And we've talked about this before, the advantages of this.
Well, we know it's a good deal because we've had this deal for 2 years. The governor's budget changed the rules in the middle of the game, which seems a little unfair just on the surface of it. But even more important, there are now some studies showing that this tax credit is a credit only after the production has generated enough tax revenue, a little more than enough tax revenue to actually pay for the credit.
By the way, Jed has brought his parakeet this morning. Delighted to welcome him to the programming as well.
Sorry. It pays for itself, and it just sustains a program that we know works. I mean, this thing has created tens of thousands of jobs with vendors included and all that stuff. And once you get to the multiplier effect, it's a stunning new part of our economy. And if we just get rid of these caps because the thing pays for itself, then the whole business could grow. We've been turning away productions. Here we have these two great marketing operations, Veep and House of Cards, and we've been turning away all the other productions. We could triple our business very quickly.
There are a lot of folks who took some umbrage at the behavior of the group that owns that is producing House of Cards, Media Rights Capital. They sent a threatening letter to the legislature, and then there were bills, you know, amendments attached to budget bills saying we're going to, you know, get eminent domain on your set up in Aberdeen and all that. That's all gone away.
Yeah, well,
that didn't seem like the classiest way of handling.
Well, it wasn't a threatening letter. It was, and I think it actually was hugely helpful because I think the legislature didn't understand that this budget number, the $7.5 million, would have meant that House of Cards would have, you know, the rules would have been changed on them and they would have gotten much less of tax credit with the same amount of work, which would have, I mean, just logically, of course, they would look around and, you know, a bunch of other states came after them. So it just alerted them and it helped a lot get at least the clarity. I mean, the legislature will do what it wants to do, but at least they'll know now what the issues are. And I think without that letter, they wouldn't have known. It wasn't threatening at all. It was just stating the facts.
They also threw a party and let everybody meet Kevin Spacey, and that seemed, you know, very Hollywoodish. So
yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah, no, they've been active down there, and it's been helpful to us. Right. To the film
so,
industry.
Ann Horty, let's talk about a movie about a gentleman who has a home in Easton,
yes.
Maryland, Donald Rumsfeld.
Mount Misery.
Mount Misery? Is that the name
that's
of it?
I think that is the name of his home. There's Mount Pleasant and Mount Misery. There's a wonderful lore attached to those domiciles.
Oh, so that's
apparently
just
Donald Rumsfeld. Yeah, lives at good old Mount Misery. Well, I hope I didn't just give out his home address. Oops.
That's all right. I'm sure that he won't get inundated with visitors.
What could happen?
But there is a movie about him. He's now in his 80s. Errol Morris, you know, the acclaimed documentary filmmaker, has turned his lens on Secretary Donald Rumsfeld for a doc called In the Unknown Known.
Yeah.
You saw this for the first time in September in Toronto. You
yes.
interviewed Mr. Morris.
I did.
A piece ran about that just the other day in the Post. What do you think? It's available on demand now. It's not
it
in
is.
Theaters around here, but you can get it on iTunes.
That is correct. It opened in theaters in Washington today, but it is available on iTunes and on demand. And it's really worth seeing. I mean, people will remember that Morris made an absolutely stunning documentary about Robert McNamara several years ago called The Fog of War, in which McNamara was just this incredibly galvanizing subject as he looked back over his career and the decisions that he made during, you know, as far back as World War II and, of course, the Vietnam era. And really, you could see a man kind of wrestling with his legacy and wrestling with his own kind of psychic imprint of all of those events and ambivalence and regret. Or self-justification. And I feel like, you know, people with that in their mind are going to expect to see that with the Rumsfeld documentary, and they're not going to see that. They're going to, it's a completely different experience because they're very different men. But in this case, I think Morris really kind of ushers us into Rumsfeld's moral imagination, or as Morris himself said, or lack thereof, because he's not a reflective guy. It's kind of built around those thousands of memos that he wrote when he was at the Pentagon and all through his political career called Snowflakes. And he has them read them out loud and then they kind of discuss them. What did you mean by that? And, you know, I think that the technique is admirable and I understand what Morris as a filmmaker was trying to do. I'm not sure it's a very satisfying film-going experience at the end of the day. You know, I'm not sure Rumsfeld himself You know, you kind of leave thinking, huh, I'm not sure that was as enlightening or as deep or probing as I might have liked.
Yeah, in your interview with Mr. Morris, he sort of anticipated a number of criticisms.
Yes, and he was getting a lot of criticism at that point. He had already opened the film in Telluride in Venice and was coming to Toronto. And by that time, you know, the buzz had started to build that he didn't push back enough. I mean, he was getting a lot of pushback himself for just not... You know, and he doesn't. I mean, there are several instances where Rumsfeld seems to have the last word, and you are kind of reflexively craving that moment of the filmmaker saying, "But sir," you know, and Morris does that obliquely. He does that with images. He does that with demonstrating when Rumsfeld contradicts himself by the he puts up newspaper articles or poll results, but you still crave that confrontation, and that's something that he does confront him on a few things, but all by and large, I mean, the feeling I got after watching it was that Rumsfeld is that he's such a smooth operator, and it's such a testament to his own ambition and careerism and canny navigation of the Washington political structure, and you kind of feel like he did it again.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's still very much worth seeing.
He was a player for a long time.
You betcha. Yeah. And he's such a compelling figure. I mean, he's very charismatic. He's just so, you know, regardless of how you feel about his policies, he's such an appealing figure. I mean, he's a very charismatic guy who's fun to watch and fun to listen to.
All right. And The Unknown Known, a documentary about Earl Morris. I want to talk about a movie, excuse me, that we talked about here in the show last week. I interviewed David Kaplan, who's a particle physicist at Johns Hopkins University, who did what I thought was a terrific movie about the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland called Particle Fever. I love this movie. Yeah. I loved everything about this movie. And I'm not a science guy, you know. Were it not for Karen Brown, I never would have gotten through biology as a sophomore in high school. And thank you, Ms. Brown. I do very much appreciate that. But what did you guys think? Jed, Particle Fever.
You know, agree with you totally, Tom. I just think it's a stunning movie in the most improbable way. And this is one of these movies you can't imagine how anybody pitched it for funders, you know, because it seems like such a tiny little audience. And I'm like you, I've never taken a physics course. I don't know anything about physics. And it so beautifully brings you into that world. And this machine that was built should have been built in Texas, but we decided it wasn't practical enough, you know, so we pulled the money, but it's in Europe, is breathtaking. And to see the scientists from all over the world and the art and mystery of what they're heading toward and how the insight into how science works is a riveting film. It's just great. Mm.
And you liked it?
Agreed on all counts. And it's especially timely given this recent, you know, the recent news stories about the Big Bang and the beginnings of the universe. And that's what they're doing. They're trying to find that Higgs boson, the so-called God particle. And it's absolutely, it's edited by Walter Murch, you know, a Hopkins graduate who himself has a long time a lifelong passion for these kinds of things. And so with him at the helm, I mean, he's the one who edited, you know, all the Coppola films and Apocalypse Now. So the man knows his way around narrative and he just keeps it going. I mean, he really ratchets up the emotion and the tension just superbly. Yeah. And also with Neil deGrasse Tyson's series Cosmos. I mean, it's just a wonderful time to be seeing this. It just adds so much to the Peter Higgs is there in the movie, in
the audience in which they are announcing essentially a validation of his life's work.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, it is a spoiler alert, but David talked about it too. But, you know, I'm weeping my eyes out.
It is.
And I'm looking at David
deep.
And I'm saying, why am I crying in a movie about physics? But I was happy to cry.
About some particle we'll never understand.
That's right. Exactly. Another movie, that's at the Charles Theater, Particle Fever. Another one that's at the Charles is another documentary. So here it is. It's interesting that we're talking about three docs in a row here. Tim's Vermeer. A story about a guy named Tim Jennison, who's an inventor in Texas, and he's trying to figure out one of the great mysteries in art. How did the Dutch painter Johannes Vermeer figure out light in a way that he did so photorealistically at a time way before photographs?
Yeah, and you're right to talk about both these movies together because, you know, here's this guy, Tim Jennison, who has no art background. He's never painted anything. He's sort of a tinkerer schlub guy, you know, he would self-describe, who made a good chunk of money doing a software package called Video Toaster. So he's got a good amount of money, and he decides he's fascinated by this thing that David Hockney and a bunch of art historians have also been fascinated by, which is just what you said. How did Vermeer do this? Because his paintings to this day are unique in the world. And Tim Jennison sets out to figure this out, spend whatever money, make whatever commitment of time it's going to take to figure it out, and not just theorize about it, but actually figure it out. And his challenge to himself is, for him, a non-painter, to recreate one of the Vermeers, one of these 34 Vermeers. And there's no data on the Vermeers. You look through them and you don't see any drawings behind them. Nobody really could figure this out. And the fascination of this process, of this guy obsessing over what happened, how could a guy in the 16th century Holland do this? And the challenge to himself is just an unbelievable movie. And like Particle Fever, the emotional layers sort of sneak up on you. And by the end of the movie, it's just overwhelming in the best way that any kind of movie can be.
Yeah. Mm.
Again, agreed. But I have to point out that a very similar story was told years ago in a movie called Waiting for Hockney that I saw at, what was it called? Oh, the Maryland Film Festival. I'll never forget it, at the Brown Center at MICA.
I have heard of that.
Yeah, in which a local painter, local artist here, Billy
Pappas.
Graphic
artist, yeah.
Yeah, was fascinated by the exact same issues and set out to make his own drawing after Vermeer. And Hockney was involved in that too, and it's just I just keep thinking about that movie so fondly, and I wish I could point people to where they could see it, but I'm not sure that you can see it anymore. So I want to make a public plea to somehow get that into the public forum. But no, you're right. This is a really gorgeous, very emotional film, and I don't want to give anything away, but yeah, it does sweep you up, and in a way, it's the kind of film Errol Morris might make in terms of just obsession, and those fusings of science and art.
Yeah,
and
another doc that we don't have time to talk about is called Mistaken for Strangers. In 10 seconds, Anne, tell us
quickly.
About that one.
Yes, this is on demand. It's about the indie rock band The National, which at first blush I thought another rock and roll documentary, ho hum, but no, it is really special. It's made by the lead singer's brother. And it has so much more to do with family dynamics and sibling love and rivalry and envy and purpose and identity. And it's so, again, very moving, very emotional. And if you like The National, good music. And even if you don't like The National, just a fantastic story.
All right. Well, Anne Hornaday, thank you very much. See you next time.
Thank
you. Jed, next time is May. That happens to be the month of the Maryland Film Festival.
Yep.
If I were a betting man, I'd say that's what we're talking about then.
Have lots to talk about then.
All right. Thanks, Jed. Appreciate it. One other note about film. The International Women and Minorities in Media Festival continues today and tomorrow. Tomorrow, Mr. Sophistication. It's a film based on the true story of comedian Ron Waters, who was a protege of the late comedian Richard Pryor. The director of that film, Danny Green, he's a Baltimore native. He'll be there to talk and at a reception after the film. That's tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. We've got more information at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Monday, Sheila talks to Sarah Vowell, who will be in St. Mary's County for the annual Mark Twain Lecture. I'll visit a thought-provoking exhibition at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. And that's Monday morning on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.